Good evening, my name is Sipo, and welcome to yet another episode of the Brave Podcast Series. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the benefits of inducing emotions. Now, the reason why we speak about inducing emotion isn't, you know, to sort of put us in the realm where we start mentioning certain methods that we can do use to sort of augment our moods and minds, not necessarily in the conventional sense. In our last episode, we spoke about the neurological effects of compassion. And prior to that, we also spoke about the neurological effects of abuse. Now, our bodies are very marvelous mechanisms to a point where it's actually possible for us to induce certain chemical responses simply in the way that we behave and, you know, go about doing things. In particular, it's possible for us to induce our own hurt as well as our own healing. Some degree. And all of it is based on the entire concept of learned behavior, you know, and that's often why, you know, a person's environment that they grow up in is so influential in the way that they actually go about, you know, in their lives. If a person grows up in an abusive environment in some way or another, they're more likely to abuse someone else. It carries over from one relationship into another. And the fact that it can do that means that, you know, the same person that was once a victim can also become a victimizer. The same applies from compassion as well, you know. Now, a lot of personality studies are based on an individual's early childhood and environment and, you know, look for a lot of consistent patterns in the way that they were raised, you know, particularly in their relationship with their parents as well as their siblings. You know, now looking past all that birth order stuff, which does tend to get a little bit drawn out, I'm just going to discuss some of the effects, you know. So there's various studies that have been conducted over the years, you know, by, you know, a few sociologists such as Skinner, you know, who's one of the pioneers when it came to behavioral therapy, which is often one of the most effective tools when it comes to alleviating certain forms of, let's say, learned behavior associated with abuse. Now, it uses some form of a cognitive behavioral aspect, meaning that, you know, those patterns that have sort of become persistent in a person's mind as well as in their neurology and psychology over time automatically start to become reinforced, you know, by other behaviors that the person partakes in. And because that behavior reinforces those habits, it's also possible for that behavior to slowly but surely diminish the influence that they have on an individual. Though it does sometimes require a little bit of help, and there are a few extreme cases who do need some definite rehabilitation process. One thing that is established that is that in some way or another, when an individual experiences some form of trauma or distress that they're unable to cope with, more often than not, they end up forming bad habits around that, you know? And a lot of the approaches that are associated with healing often revolve around normalizing a person's suffering to a point where they see that other people that have gone through similar experiences actually exist, you know, because abuse is quite an isolating process. Most people, you know, feel a sense of shame or a sense of obligation to protect someone else's reputation. And in so doing, you know, because their sense of self-preservation as well as, you know, desire to preserve, let's say, someone they're in an intimate relationship, is so highly stimulated, they end up making a lot of irrational decisions as a result of that and behaving in a lot of irrational ways. Their behavior stands out as something that does reinforce, you know, a lot of neurological as well as cognitive patterns, you know. It's possible to think about malicious acts, but the moment a person perpetrates them, then all of a sudden they become real. You know, and the moment an act such as that becomes real, it becomes harder for a person to actually, you know, alleviate themselves of it. You know? Now, to some degree, we all experience some form of anger. And what our behavior tells us is that in the same way as anger might be part of our makeup, then there are certain behaviors associated with it that sort of reinforce and that can also induce anger, you know. And a lot of the times when it comes to these personality studies that are based in an individual's early childhood environment, they talk about how certain emotional states were consistent patterns. Say a person's parents were arguing. There was a certain amount of dysfunctionality that was consistent in that individual's life to a point where it starts to form a sense of normalcy for them. You know, a person becomes a lot more anxious without this in their lives. And when it comes to the neurological effect that this has, you know, there's certain chemicals that are produced in the brain. And because certain levels of these chemicals are being produced when it comes to a person responding to certain external as well as internal stimuli, what happens is that the person eventually develops, you know, sort of a go-to place with regards to, you know, inducing certain substances as well as chemical responses in their brain. And in order to sort of help clarify that process, I'm just going to use, you know, a comparison between self-induced emotional states as well as, you know, those induced by external stimuli. Now, when it comes to external stimuli, there's the entire concept of death by a thousand cuts. You know, I'm not implying that to be malicious. It's just they're not as powerful as the internal stimuli, you know. The self-induced stimulus is often what determines whether an individual can, you know, overcome certain trauma or reinforce it. So when it comes to, say, anger in particular, when a person grows up in an environment where the parents are constantly arguing, there's a lot of dysfunctionality in that environment, then they, in some way or another, tend to internalize that dysfunctionality. And there's that internalization process which sort of continues to perpetuate it. Even when the situation is gone, then what a person does is that whenever they find themselves in a distressing situation, what their mind does is that it takes them back into, you know, that early childhood state where they look for a form of soothing. And what they do is if that form of soothing was related to a substance or let's say some type of abuse, then they begin to perpetuate that in some way or another, you know? And that's only the case until an individual comes to realize a sense of power that they have with regards to that. And that's why I actually wanted to speak a lot more about the self-induction process of, you know, well, self-induction process of creating certain emotional states in one person, in a person's mind. So in the same way that, you know, anger can be quite a potent form of social conditioning, that, you know, can augment a person's thinking, so can compassion. You know, that's what the two previous episodes were about, you know, to just demonstrate how compassion is transcendent to empathy and how that can often, you know, determine whether or not a person, you know, develops a high sense of value for their own well-being or not, as well as those of others. And it also drew a line as to how, you know, abuse can act to impair a person, whereas compassion can act to, you know, sort of rehabilitate them in some way or another. And a lot of rehabilitation processes are often based on that concept, you know, like let's take addiction, for example. A lot of addicts are said to suffer from what's known as a self-care disorder. And for that reason, you know, a person's behavior over time, you know, tends to, you know, perpetuate that, the people that they associate with. There's a very heavy social element when it comes to addiction, to a point where it's impossible to actually, you know, treat a person unless one can properly understand their social context. And upon doing so, what a person can do is they can start to sort of use that very same social context to start to override certain thinking patterns. In essence, a person can't necessarily think their way into positive behavior when it comes to them, you know, having recovered from some form of a substance abuse, or maybe they've been in some type of a traumatic experience, or maybe they've been in an abusive relationship. But it does become possible for a person to eventually, slowly but surely, start to act their way into better thinking, which tends to perpetuate itself in the inverse process as well. Now, when it comes to that entire concept of self-induced mental states or emotional states, you know, in early childhood, you know, a person will go back to the way they felt when their parents argued, you know. And what that does is that it puts a person in a position where they sort of develop a sense of dependency on a certain amount of turmoil in their lives, because these induce some type of an emotional state, and because our emotional states are often representative of certain chemical reactions that are happening in our minds. What this does tend to do is that it does tend to put a person in a position where they've in some way or another begun to, you know, augment their own chemistry by inducing certain emotions. Now, the initial trauma may have passed, but then after that, when it comes down to it, and it's not a matter of placing blame on the person that was victimized, but the person that was victimized to some degree develops a sense of power that they're not quite aware of up until they get to a point where they start becoming a lot more clear on how their behavior contributes to the certain presence of certain emotions in their overall emotional state. And I know this is a rather vague episode, but that's just what I wanted to talk to you, you know, as a precursor to our next episode, which is, you know, compassion in practice. And that's how induced emotional states, particularly self-induced emotional states, are very powerful driving forces to either reinforcing change or reinforcing, you know, unhealthy patterns or changing them. I apologize for, you know, the slurring of the words. I do get sometimes a little bit tongue-tied when it comes to these concepts, you know. Me and they do tend to invoke some type of emotional response from me as well. But when it comes to the entire concept of using compassion as a force for change, you know, it does invoke, you know, quite a pleasant emotion, which does excite me. And that's part in part why, you know, I've been a little bit nervous when it comes to carrying this across, you know, because I don't want to actually, you know, do so in a way that puts people at a disadvantage. You know, I want to do the very best I can with this concept. Because to some degree, compassion demands that I do the very same healing I've been applying to myself. I'm hoping that, you know, I can at least contextualize. Even though it may not be the exact same process, I hope that the elements of which are quite consistent through and through, and it can always be personalized to help accommodate anyone else. And that's going to be part of it, you know. It's going to be part of a 6-episode workshop called, you know, the power of love, in essence, you know, which is something that we do tend to, you know, practice quite a lot here at Tough Love, you know. And what this is going to do is that it's going to add a lot of psychological validity to the entire process, in the hopes that, you know, it doesn't estrange people from it. You know, a lot of people often look at support groups and they're quite apprehensive about the fact that they have to go into, you know, a group, you know, and then sort of start discussing their issues with someone else. And they don't really see any medical benefit to it. But then it comes down to the fact that a lot of the 12-step programs that exist today that are, you know, one of the most effective methods when it comes to helping people break addictive cycles, including abuse and codependence, initially started off as a sociological movement. Initially, I said that, you know, a person's social context as well as their social cognition is often a very powerful, you know, factor in reinforcing behavior, as well as helping a person identify with what themselves, as well as the role that they have in their lives. And it's often this part which, you know, is an area of focus when it comes to establishing some form of change. And for that reason, compassion in particular, which is an approach in which one approaches another person or themselves in a social and interactive way, can act as a driving force for change. But before I go on too much about it, the workshop hasn't started yet. I'll end it there. Thank you very much. And I hope you did enjoy this episode of the Brave Podcast series. Have a good night.